KALW.
I just got very frustrated with it, the idea that because I'm a female, I can't talk in God's house. I have to sit back here where even if I did speak, no one's going to really hear me.
A Muslim convert feels her access to God was being limited by men.
I couldn't talk to the imam. Men talked to him all the time. He'd be standing up there. They'd be laughing at some joke. Men would talk to him. Women, no.
She was searching for a spiritual home and decided to build one for herself.
We need to have a different setup for worshiping. That's it. That women are not second-class citizens. Women are equal to men.
That's coming up. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Today, our show will be dedicated to a story from the new series, Becoming Muslim, a special project from KALW and The Spiritual Edge. It's stories about Americans who chose Islam and the dynamics and conflicts they faced after they did. Contrary to media depictions and stereotypes around Muslim women, women have been a vocal, powerful part of the Muslim story from the beginning, and Black Muslim women have been at the forefront of Islam's growth in America. Today, I want to introduce you to Rabia Keeble. As far back as Rabia can remember, she was interested in religion and the Bible. Her mother tells this story.
And the repairman was in the house doing something, and he was flirting with my mother, because my mother's very pretty. And I heard it. I was in the other room, and I came out, and I said, "You're not supposed to covet. You're coveting my mother. You're not supposed to covet your ox, your ass, your neighbor's wife." That's as much as I can remember of what I had read. And they both just cracked up. They were like rolling on the floor that I'm standing there like some prophet, you know. "You're not supposed to flirt with my mother."
It's a cute story, but it also shows Rabia's early rebelliousness and her tendency to think for herself. And that same spirit emerged decades later when she was becoming Muslim. She was going to Friday prayers in Oakland back in the 90s, and early on, she started noticing something that bothered her. Usually after the prayer, there's a time for the imam to talk to congregants and answer their questions. But
I couldn't talk to the imam in the mosque. It was like men could talk. Men talked to him all the time. He'd be standing up there. They'd be laughing at some joke. Men would talk to him. Women, no.
Like many mosques, the setting was the imam is at the front of the prayer hall, the men right behind him, and women.
We sat behind the men. And so I got to see that men were allowed so much more openness and leeway to grow their understandings. It's like, if I can ask a question, then and I can get an answer, then I can grow that much more.
Rabia was new to Islam, and she was thirsty to learn from the imam. Her frustration built, and she kept seeing this widening divide between her and the teachings. This lack of access to the imam, it irked her. She says she felt her access to God was being limited, too.
I just got very frustrated with it, the idea that because I'm a female, I can't talk in God's house. Because I'm a female, I have to sit back here where even if I did speak, no one's going to really hear me. And the whole thing implies I'm not worthy. We're going to sit you in back with all the squalling babies and all the gossiping aunties because we know you're not paying attention because you're a woman.
Rabia grew more and more discontented with the mosque, and a thought started to form.
I just started to conceive of a learning space, of a worship space that was absolutely friendly to women, that would give women the advantages to grow, of growth, spiritual growth, intellectual growth, whatever it is.
So Rabia made a plan, got a little grant, and in 2017, she launched a women-led mosque in Berkeley, and she welcomed anyone who wanted to join, no matter their gender. A local seminary gave her a room where her first service was held.
So I said, here's what we'll do. We'll teach and learn how to do Juma together.
Friday prayer.
You will learn how to do, how to lead prayer. You will learn how to call the azan.
The call to prayer.
You will learn how to give a khutbah.
The sermon.
You will learn all the liturgy of Islam. So we started getting to the point where some ladies went and studied at home and came back and were able to lead prayer. Never done it before. And did it beautifully. Beautifully.
This is sound from that first service. After that day, Friday prayers were held every week with the sermons given by women. Guest speakers were women and the imams, women. She named the mosque Qalbu Maryam, the heart of Mary. Mary being Mary, the mother of Jesus, who's held in such high regard by Islam that she's the only woman mentioned by name in the Quran.
In the last 15 to 20 years, a lot of convert communities started to create their own mosques and their own third spaces.
That's Hind Mekki. She's an interfaith educator with the Institute on Social Policy and Understanding in Chicago. And they commissioned a study on mosques called Reimagining Muslim Spaces.
What if you were asked to recall the best moment you had at a mosque?
Hind and her team consult with mosques on how to be more welcoming to women. She says converts tend to launch new spaces based on what they're missing in mainstream mosques, whether it has to do with gender or language, access to learning, or just belonging.
They're creating third spaces. And what third spaces here means is that these are not necessarily mosques, but they're centers for Muslim community building.
And one of Rabia's biggest issues, access to learning from the imam, Hind Mekki says it wasn't a problem in the Prophet Muhammad's mosque 1,400 years ago, and it shouldn't be a problem today.
And so the Prophet, peace be upon him, would give lessons before and after prayers, and women would be there, and women would talk and engage with him and ask him questions, and he would respond. And even during, you know, a specific time when some women thought that the men were hogging him and hogging his time, they complained, and he responded by setting aside an entire day for them.
But ironically, in 21st century Berkeley, California, Rabia's challenge to the mainstream didn't go over so well.
That was like being in labor with a child. Because one part of me didn't want to do it because I knew what was going to happen. I knew I was going to be attacked. I knew that people who were not comfortable with themselves would feel uncomfortable with me and judge me and critique me and attack me. And it happened just like that.
Rabia was born to a Black Christian family in the Midwest. She grew up in St. Louis, Chicago, and Ohio. Though her parents weren't really religious, she was surrounded by Christianity through her extended family, her community. And there was that Bible in the house.
I had this curiosity about who Jesus was because, you know, Black people have this thing about kind of elbowing God to the side, but Jesus, you know, becomes like everything. And I was like, well, who is this Jesus? And that is kind of a hallmark of who I am, is that I don't buy stuff just because somebody's selling it, you know. I go, okay, I'll look at it, then I'll figure it out.
And there were a couple of things that especially bothered her.
I didn't particularly care for a white Jesus. I didn't particularly care for a male God. It didn't sit well with me.
That skepticism makes sense when you consider what Rabia would have faced as a young Black woman making her way in the world. During college, she joined friends on a road trip to California and ended up staying in Berkeley, where she found a job at a law firm.
And I remember, this is so funny, I remember being so immature, so green. So I'm working in this office and all these Caucasian ladies are there, and they're the legal secretaries. They have their certificates in legal secretariness. And I'm just this little black kid in the front, you know, doing my thing, and I'm just doing my thing.
And even though this was California and this was Berkeley, a place famous for progressive politics and supposed racial harmony, Rabia got a rude awakening. Those legal secretaries,
they just gave me the hardest time. They just gave me the hardest time. They said I smelled bad. They would put bars of soap on my desk. They would do all sorts of horrible things to me.
Those racist experiences planted a seed in Rabia, the seed that would grow into a career involving civil rights and social justice work. She left that law firm, went through a number of other jobs, and ended up in nursing, which she practiced for years. But throughout, the one constant was her love of the Bible, and she was still pondering and wondering about God.
And I thought, well, the larger part of the Bible is the Torah. I need to study with a rabbi. I want to really understand what's in this Bible from top to bottom.
Rabia ended up studying with a rabbi, and eventually she converted to Judaism. At the time, in her off hours, Rabia was spending a lot of time at the library in Berkeley, reading about all kinds of things, social justice, history, spirituality. And one day,
I was at the library and I saw a flyer for Sufi healing.
Sufi healing. Sufis are Muslims who follow Sufism, a mystical movement within Islam. Its dedicated followers are members of certain fellowships called Sufi orders. Sufism focuses on an inward reflection, and the goal is forging a direct relationship with the divine. Being Sufi can overlap with being Sunni or Shia Muslim. They follow a leader, a sheikh. They study under them and engage in mystical worship practices like deep meditation, trances, and dhikr, repeated melodic chanting of the name of God. Literally, dhikr means remembrance of God. You may know Sufism from the poetry of Persian Sufi poet Jalaluddin Rumi and from images of the whirling dervishes of Turkey. Now for Rabia, she knew none of this. All she knew was she was curious about this Sufi healing. The class on the flyer was held at the Graduate Theological Union. It's not far from her, so she went.
And I sat and listened to this sheikh.
We are like these candles. They take a long time to burn, but in reality they are burning from inside. And they are melting from within.
And in this religious group, there was an idea of God that was new to Rabia.
I began to learn and understand that there is this other approach to God, of loving God like you would love a lover. I'd never heard of that before.
Rabia was enamored by the concept.
And I thought, yes. Yes, that's how we're supposed to love God. We're supposed to love God like we love a lover, longing, you know, like, oh, I want to talk to you so bad. I want to hold you so much. I can't eat. I can't sleep unless I have you. That's how we're supposed to love God, you know? And I thought, this is wonderful. This is what I've been looking for.
But there was one thing. Rabia was Jewish now. What did that mean? Wasn't this a conflict? Did she have to renounce Judaism?
I thought to myself, essentially, Judaism has laid the foundation for me to understand and enjoy and love Islam. Because Islam and Judaism are not miles apart. They are inches apart. Just as Christianity informs a lot of what is in Islam. So I didn't feel like I had gone really anywhere. I had just stepped through a doorway, and that was it.
You're listening to Becoming Muslim, a series from KALW's The Spiritual Edge. You can hear more great stories like the one you're hearing right now by subscribing to The Spiritual Edge on your podcast player or ask your smart speaker to play The Spiritual Edge. Now, back to the story. Rabia knew she wanted to know more about Islam from this sheikh and his teachings. One day after class, she asked her friend to take her up to him.
Sheikh Hisham, he's with the Naqshbandi Sufi order. And I didn't know anything about Naqshbandis and all this. I just followed this sheikh because I enjoyed his teaching. She took me up to him, and I'm standing in front of him, and I'm looking at this man. Now, I believe in mysticism. I've seen a lot of things. I walked up to this man and he had like a glow around him. And I didn't know him, I didn't know anything about him. But I saw this as I was standing there. I wasn't impressed as much as I was mystified. And he asked me, he said, did anyone put you up to this? He says, have you come here on your own from your heart? I said, yes. He said, then take my cane. And I held it. And he started to pray. And he prayed a long time to the point where everybody was looking around and going, well, when is he going to give her shahada? Shahada is the attestation of faith for a Muslim. And he says, now, this part, he says, you repeat it after me.
Rabia was now Muslim. And one of her favorite parts of Islam was that ritual, dhikr. They were held every Saturday night at the seminary.
I never missed one. You commit this time to simply sitting and chanting and remembering God's name, the parts of God. The 99 names are actually 99 attributes of God. And just like letting your heart explode in love and worship of God for hours with other folks. And it's wonderful. It changed me. It mellowed me. It did all kinds of things to me. This is a mystery. It's a mystery.
Rabia would start coming to the mosque for services, Friday prayers, dhikr. She met lots of new friends, but something bothered her. That lack of access to the imam, that she had to sit in the back of the prayer hall.
The one thing I had a problem with was we need to have a different setup for worshiping. That's it. That women are not second-class citizens. Women are equal to men.
Rabia began studying Islamic theology at Berkeley's Graduate Theological Union. That's where she first met the sheikh. She immersed herself in the religion, and to her, the texts she was studying at school, they just didn't jibe with what was happening at the mosque. In many verses, the Quran asserts or alludes to the notion that men and women are spiritual equals, but it seemed that Muslim practice had often veered from that. To Rabia, what was happening was something that often happens to religions, where a faith is practiced differently by different cultures. A Muslim in an Arabian village will probably practice some things differently than one in the south side of Chicago, for example. And like her mosque, many mosques in the U.S. are led by immigrant imams, born, raised, and taught in societies where gender segregation is the norm in religious settings.
And I understand that some people see modesty and chastity and, you know, preserving the feminine Muslima in a certain, you know, encased in amber and she must be this way. No. There's many different ways to be a Muslim woman.
Rabia founded her women-led mosque, Qalbu Maryam, in April 2017.
Northern California's first female-led mosque officially.
It was a big deal. The mayor of Berkeley showed up, local media turned out, and a woman, Suraya Dean, a Muslim lawyer and activist, gave the first sermon.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Soraya does interfaith and women empowerment work in Muslim communities. She met Rabia on Facebook, and they hit it off.
Like me, she was sick of the patriarchy. She was sick of men telling us what to do, what to believe, what to wear, what color even to wear. So then this was burning in her, and we were talking about this, and to speak to the women, it's okay. You have the agency with your God. You have a right to talk with him. You have a right to do what you want with him, to do with the theology. So then Rabia invited me to do the khutbah. I just said yes.
Alhamdulillah. Alhamdulillah.
So the night before, I went to Rabia's. We stayed the night, talked all night, and there was a big morning that was coming, but we slept, I think, 2 hours.
Soraya gets excited when she remembers that day.
So we get dressed, we go to the mosque, the designated place, and we set it up. It was very, very exciting. And there were so many people who came, men and women together. And we created a sacred, hallowed space. And Rabia just worked so hard for that.
Rabia was on the news, in the papers, with images of women in headscarves leading prayer. This was the second women-led mosque in the country, but it was the first that also welcomed men.
A lot of women came because they thought it was just a women's mosque. And I let them know I cannot repeat the mistake that patriarchy has taught us. We separate nobody here. That's segregation. Just like the civil rights movement. Segregation means that, you know, I think I'm better than you. Some women didn't like that. And they came and they came and they came, and finally they left because men were coming too. And a lot of the men I spoke to believe 100% that men and women should worship together. And some of them were Arab. You know, some were Iranian, some were whatever, you know. And one man told me, he said, I like this idea. I don't ever want my daughter to feel that she's subservient to any man. And he was bringing his daughter.
Rabia's congregation was also culturally diverse, a hallmark of those third spaces converts create that mosque researcher Hind Mekki talked about.
These mosques are as diverse as the Muslim population is in the U.S. If you go into a mosque in most cities or small towns in the U.S., you don't actually see that racial diversity, except for a handful of mosques that really reflect the racial diversity of the national community. But in these, like, women-led spaces, whether it's an all-woman space or a mixed-gender space, you see that racial diversity. And so the first thing I glean from that is that people from all different backgrounds are wanting something different from what the mosques are providing them.
But there was something else. When Islam came in the 7th century, it brought with it new ideas. It shook things up. At the time, it was daring and disruptive to the status quo. Muhammad came with new social rules that were challenging to the traditions of the tribes of Arabia. He was persecuted so badly, he eventually had to leave his hometown. Rabia was shaking things up too, and she had to face the consequences. To find out what ended up happening to Rabia and her mosque, subscribe to The Spiritual Edge on your podcast player. We drop a new story every Friday as part of our series Becoming Muslim, a project of The Spiritual Edge. Jeb Sharp is the editor, Tariq Foda is the engineer, our executive editor is Judy Silber. Funding for Becoming Muslim comes from the Templeton Religion Trust. For more details, go to KELW.org. Today's Cross Currents team includes Dorothy Tang, Johanna Miyake, James Rollins, Gabe Graben, Victor Tense, Shirin Adil, Lisa Morehouse, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Dawood Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.